Jean-Michel Cousteau virtually grew up exploring the oceans while living aboard his father Jacques Cousteau's research vessel, the Calypso. Jacques Cousteau was the preeminent pioneer of underwater exploration. He co-invented the original scuba diving equipment and underwater submersibles and has produced more than 100 films and TV shows about his journeys. Jean-Michel Cousteau continued the family tradition. He's a founding director of the Cousteau Society and is currently the executive producer of the TV series Cousteau's Rediscovery of the World, which is being produced for Turner Broadcasting. He also writes a newspaper column on the environment that's published by the Los Angeles Times Syndicate. Jean-Michel Cousteau led a recent expedition to Papua New Guinea. The Rediscovery TV series will feature a 3-hour special on the trip in January. It has also been documented in a new book of text and photographs published by Abrams. I asked Jean-Michel Cousteau why he wanted to go to Papua New Guinea.
We started in 73 going out there almost by accident, and I really got to like that part of the world, pretty much untouched, pretty much unexplored, and definitely not in the minds of anybody. I found an extremely rich culture. I found an extremely rich fauna and flora when it comes to the land as well as underwater. And being a water person, I got to explore extensively some of the offshore islands of Papua New Guinea and kept going back there for 5 years with groups of people, students of mine, participants, people who had a keen interest in discovering another part of the world. And the reward there was that for once, I could take my father to a place where he had never been before. For 50 years, he took me to the places he knew. And there I could take him to a place he had no knowledge of. And I held his hand and showed him underwater and above water what it's like. And that was quite a reward for me.
One of the highlights of your trip to New Guinea was diving and finding orca whales that were on a hunt. Why is it so rare to find that?
Well, first of all, to be able to swim in the open water with clear water is very unusual. You can find orcas, for example, in Canada or even the United States, and usually the water is not very clear. The fact that they also accept to stay with you is very unusual. We were able to jump in the water and stay with these orcas for 9 hours nonstop around one of the little islands in New Guinea. And not only were they there, there were two of them permanently, and a third one came and left, but we witnessed something which had never been seen before, never recorded before, and we were able not only to take pictures but to film it. And that was orcas feeding. They would disappear in the dark blue and come back with an entire 8 or 9 foot shark in their jaws. And they would literally play with it just like a cat would play with a mouse, and ultimately tear it apart and eat it. And we witnessed all of that. The very fact that we saw predator number one feeding on predator number two was an unbelievable sight, and it was of, I guess, great scientific significance because it allowed us not only to record it, but to pass it on to the scientists specialized in marine mammals and the orca in particular.
Did anything surprise you about the way the whales attacked and ate the shark?
That didn't surprise us because we knew they feed on big things. They occasionally, like a pack of wolf, would attack a small whale and eat it. They've been seen doing that. But to see them go and get sharks was very surprising. What surprised me the most, though, is that they would do it in front of us. You know, there's no record of orcas having attacked a human being in the wild. It has happened in captivity, but never in the wild. But looking at them doing this right in front of us made one think a little bit.
How big is an orca whale?
20 to 25 feet easily.
So when you're down there filming, do you have to use a lot of underwater lights to get a good picture?
Depends on the conditions. In the case of the orcas, we had no lighting, no artificial lights. We use available light. We are in the open water. There is no background except that deep blue, which the ocean is when it's good conditions. We use a lot of lights, on the other hand, when we film a close-up subject on the reef or something happening, a large school of fish or a kelp bed, for example, here in California. And we often have to shut off our lights in certain circumstances because it scares off the animals.
Mm-hmm. So
we use the lights every time we can because it restores the real colors and the water, which you don't see otherwise. But sometimes we cannot do it.
So the orca whales didn't attack you. Has a sea creature ever attacked you? Did you ever wrestle a sea creature in the tradition of all the underwater movies? does this happen in real life for divers?
No. We've been bothered by sharks many times in different circumstances, different areas. Sharks are have a very bad reputation, and fortunately, most people don't realize that there are more than 250 species of sharks. Most of them are totally harmless. Very few, and I'll say less than 10 species, would potentially represent a problem if the conditions for the problems to take place were put together, and that means blood in the water, whether it's another animal or yourself, a certain sign of panic, like you would make it sense to a dog when you're scared, which would allow that animal to run after you. Most accidents which have taken place are due to someone being spearfishing, for example, and then you have a shark coming to get the prey, to get the fish. But if you're in the way, you may get in trouble. A lot of accidents have taken place by sharks attacking people by mistake, taking them for something else, taking them for maybe a seal or taking them for an animal. And then they realize their mistake, but it's too late. You've been hurt, and perhaps you may end up bleeding to death. So these things are happening. Very few, though. I mean, there are many fewer people that died from shark attacks than people died from bee stings. But that's, not as spectacular.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Jean-Michel Cousteau, who is a founding director of the Cousteau Society. His father is Jacques Cousteau. And Jean-Michel Cousteau is the co-author of a new book on his expedition to Papua New Guinea. You've been diving just about all your life. How has ocean pollution affected what you see when you're underwater now? And I know this changes from region to region, but I'm sure you see the difference underwater from, compared to what it was like when you started.
Well, I've seen changes in Southern California, for example. I've seen my own backyard in south of France being depleted to the point and polluted to the point where I don't go back there diving anymore, and I cannot show my own kids what I used to see when I was their age. It's impossible for me to go out and point out things and share. It's all of memories, and that's unfair. It's unfair to the kids, unfair to the generations to come. We have to cease to look at the ocean as a universal sewer in which you can dump everything, thinking that out of sight, out of mind.
In the south of France, where you grew up, where you used to dive and where you dive no longer, compare what it looked like then to what it looks like now.
I remember very clear waters. I remember an abundance of marine life. When you go back today, the water is turbid. The ocean floor is covered with foreign objects, whether it's cans or plastic, which are absorbed by a lot of species of animals and kill them by internal infections. Many of the species of fish that we used to find on the market sold by the fishermen are now gone. And the ones that we didn't take in those days because they were looked upon or considered as second rate or no good to eat are the ones you find on the market today. And so because we've eliminated the good stuff, now we're going for something which is not necessarily as good. And I'm talking about taste, not necessarily the value of the proteins, which I'm sure they still have at least as good as the others.
You've been to Alaska to the site of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. You have some suggestions for how to prevent future oil spills, and I'd like you to share some of those.
Yes, we went up to the Valdez, Exxon Valdez and Prince William Sound area 6 times so far. We're going to go back this winter. We're producing a one-hour special on the issue, and we're going to suggest all kinds of solutions to the problems that we faced with. From a human aspect, based on the fact that a man alone is in bad company, we feel that you should have, in sensitive areas, 2 people in charge of skipping the boat. So you need 2 skippers for that period of time. We suggest also that vessels should be the size of what the cleanup technology can afford in that particular area. So we will probably have to deal with smaller size vessels for the time being, and maybe they can grow as the technology and the equipment grows. We suggest that there be a double hull system, and there are different systems. I will not go into that, but double hull is necessary. We strongly recommend 2 engines and 2 propellers so a ship can turn much faster, which is not the case with most tankers these days. We strongly recommend, and this is probably very easy to implement, that we have in all those sensitive areas exactly what we have with our airlines, with our aviation system. We need to do the very, very same thing with vessels, not just tankers, any vessels, in those sensitive areas, and we have to have ocean controllers.
Like air traffic controllers.
Exactly. And if you have ocean controllers or traffic controllers, ocean traffic controllers, and you dispatch them wherever they have to be all around the country of the United States, it's going to cost you much less than the cleanup of one accident such as the Exxon Valdez. For that kind of money, my God, we can equip the entire country overnight.
Your father is Jacques Cousteau, and you grew up largely on his ship, the Calypso. The ship was a World War II minesweeper. How did your family get it?
Well, my father was in the Navy and was very interested about what was going under the keel of his ships. During his private time, weekends and holidays and vacations, he would explore, manufacture equipment and so on. And in 1950, he decided to take a leave of absence from the French Navy, Calypso, which was at the time a retired minesweeper, which was built in Seattle, Washington in 1942. And that ship, which had been manufactured for the British Navy, was then decommissioned on the island of Malta in the Mediterranean Sea, and she was being a ferry. And as a ferry boat, you know, not a very glorious career, that gentleman gave Calypso, which was already named Calypso, by the way, to my dad in 1950. We were not at lib to give his name away up to now. Only after his death. Unfortunately, he died last year, and now we can say that it was Noel Guinness, a British gentleman from England, who took advantage of his fortune to allow my father to start with the ship Calypso.
Was the Calypso your home when you were a child?
Very much so. We, from that point on, from 50 on, we used to spend all of our holidays and vacations on board, whether it was Christmas, Easter, and mostly, of course, the summer. So we spent 3 to 4 months a year on the ship as we grew up. My mother looked at my brother and myself in those days, and she had a suitcase in her hand and said, "Kids, you're on your own." And she moved on board and has been on board Calypso ever since. When we were in the Amazon in 82, 83, she spent 10 months on the ship without spending a night ashore.
Well, how did you feel when she told you that you're on your own?
That was great. You know, kids always want to get away from the parents. So
this time the parents came away from the kids.
and them away from the kids. So we went to boarding school, and the time with the family became quality time. And that was wonderful.
Did your father teach you to swim?
Kind of. I think I was scuba diving before I knew how to swim. It was mostly going under rather than staying on the surface.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever scared when you were young and scuba diving? And I should mention that your father invented the equipment that you used, right, to scuba dive?
Yeah, he co-invented with an engineer, Emile Gagnon, the regulator, which is part of the scuba equipment and allows you to breathe compressed air or compressed gas at the ambient pressure without getting into major diving accidents. And that was a breakthrough which put the equipment into the public.
Mm-hmm.
So no, I never got scared. I have some great memories of great times with both my parents and my brother. And we, as a family, we were pretty much systematically exploring the French Riviera for hundreds of miles. I didn't know any better. I didn't know other kids didn't do that. I thought it was a normal family affair, just like you go skiing. And it's only later on that I realized that I was growing alongside a pioneer, because not only was that part of his life the beginning of a discovery, but he kept inventing things all the time. And that was due to his motivation of discovering more, going deeper, staying longer. And every time he couldn't find the equipment on the shelves or existing somewhere, he would make it himself. And together with, of course, a bunch of associates, mostly engineers.
How has the diving equipment changed since you were a child and started to dive?
Not much. It's smaller, it's more streamlined, it looks better, but the fundamental principles of diving have not changed that much.
And what about the film equipment? How has film equipment changed since your family started filming underwater?
Well, film equipment has not changed that much. What has changed is the emulsions, the quality of the film itself. We're still using emulsion film. We're not yet into video at this point. We don't feel that the quality of video, particularly underwater, represent the real quality and sensitivity of what's there.
Your brother, Philippe, died in a plane crash. I was wondering if that changed the way you saw your role in the family and in the Cousteau Society.
Well, very much so. My brother was the star. He was the cameraman, and he was the star in front of the camera. And I had to fill that role too, which was really not my cup of tea. I'm not attracted by the stardom aspect, but because of the confidence which was given to the Cousteau Society by our members throughout the world, we felt, and I felt very deeply, that I had to fill that role, because the show goes on. We don't stop, and we'll never stop.
Mm-hmm. Jean-Michel Cousteau is my guest. Can I ask you to describe the worst diving experience you ever had?
I think I keep that question has been asked before. I keep coming back to the same experience. I was once in a cave, and I realized I was running out of air. We were about 75 feet deep and 150 feet into the cave. And I went to turn my air reserve on, which was a natural process in those days, and realized that my air reserve was already on, so I had no air at all. And what had happened is that as I was making my way into the cave, I banged on the ceiling of the cave several times and probably turned my air reserve on by accident and did not realize it. So I was out of air, and there was absolutely no way I could swim 150 feet horizontally and then 75 feet up and make it. So all the things you learn when you learn to dive came back in a fraction of a second. And I realized that the first thing I had to do was to get to my buddy. And he was there, not very far, and we instantly started buddy breathing, and we made our way out that way. But there is that fraction of a second, which seems to be hours, during which you say, well, that's it, I've had it. And that was very unpleasant.
Do you always dive with somebody?
That's an absolute rule. People who do go diving, and I have some friends who do it, who do go diving alone are fools. They're crazy. They put very little value on life. And the absolute rule is to always dive with somebody. Always.
Does your father still dive?
My father is unbelievable. Last year, I took him diving in Papua New Guinea, and that's featured in the book, in the films as well. And he was feeling not very comfortable there. He was kind of unhappy. He came out of the water. We came out of the water, and as he was recovering, he was 78, he's now 79. As he was kind of recovering and downing his equipment, he said, "You know, I'm getting old." And I felt he was depressed, and I didn't want to hear him say, "I'm going to quit." But not at all. About 5 minutes later, as he felt bad, he said, "You know, I'm going to design equipment for old people." And that's what he did. And that meant to readapt some of his equipment and put the regulator, double hose regulator, right on his chest, which physiologically makes it a lot easier for him to breathe, in essence. And he's been, this year, he's been back in Indonesia, diving like a fish. We couldn't keep him out of the water. And he was even holding a camera in the water and filming himself. So at 79, he's just like a young kid. He's driving me up the wall.
Okay, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
You're very welcome. I enjoy this very much.